right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Thursday, March 26, 2015. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Thursday. I don't know what the temperature is today, but it is probably, I'd say, about 40 degrees. Overcast and looking like it's about to rain here. So not a very, well, I guess it is spring-like. I'm not complaining. So listen, today I actually got up early. And look out, because I've put together quite a number of things that I ran across last night and this morning that kind of dovetails onto some of the things that we've been talking about over the last few days. Yesterday, we took a look at dopamine and the production of, actually, maybe that was 2 days ago, the production of dopamine in the brain, how electronic devices, video games is kind of where we started, but electronic device use such as smartphones and computers and whatever causes also this production of dopamine. And dopamine, of course, is in the part of the brain that causes addiction. But I ran across a really interesting article this morning that kind of outlined just what technology does to us in general. And I kind of wanted to start out here. I was having trouble with Skype connecting for playing clips, so we'll see how that goes. Worst case, we'll have to bounce to the other machine. But anyway, all right, so check this out. Titled Overstimulation and Desensitization. We've talked about desensitization to violence and things of that nature many times. How civilization affects your brain. One way to think about our own brain personality and physiology is to consider our sensitivity levels to various neurotransmitters and hormones. Being desensitized or oversensitized to various aspects of our own chemical control systems will drive our behavior and emotions. And what's interesting about what we're looking at, the brain chemicals, and then tie that to the brain project and all these high-tech companies that have jumped on board to do all this research and understanding the brain, and then add to that, you know, our National Institute of Health, universities all over the country, all seeded by DARPA money. And then the robotics revolution, of course, you really do start to see the way the direction is heading. And once they crack that secret of the brain, what fires, I mean, fMRIs have been wonderful to show them the areas of the brain that interact when we think things or we do certain activities, for them to understand, you know, what's going on inside. And now as they're messing around with nanotechnology, the Connectome Project, what did we just see yesterday? Oh, the those hair-thin fibers that will now allow them to put electrodes in the brain. We saw DARPA had their chip, brain chip, that they were starting to experiment with for PTSD soldiers. So, I mean, this, none of this is accidental. It's all happening at the same time because there, of course, is this grand picture of being able to usurp every aspect of our biology and have control over it. So, anyway, let's dig a little bit more. Being desensitized or oversensitized to various aspects of our own chemical control systems will drive our behavior and emotions. And this happens whether or not we are aware of it. So you might as well try to understand what's going on in our own brains and endocrine system. Most people who live with artificial light, electronic devices, internet connections, abundant food, processed food, and other conveniences of modern life will eventually experience some degree of being out of whack in terms of neurotransmitter or hormone sensitivity. For example, too many high glycemic meals, high in sugar and or starch, can lead to insulin resistance. The pancreas is constantly secreting insulin to keep blood sugar levels in check, and cellular tissues throughout the body become less sensitive to its effect. The result can be type 2 diabetes, a devastating condition which progressively destroys the body and shortens the lifespan. In similar ways, there is some evidence that the brain can become resistant to serotonin, resulting in depression. Now, serotonin is another one of those chemicals that serotonin actually controls, like, your awake and your sleep cycle. And they are pretty certain that by having low levels of serotonin, you don't get good sleep. I'm pretty sure that that is how it works. Here, let's read a little bit more. What chronically causes elevated serotonin levels, you ask? Well, once again, high glycemic meals may be a culprit, which I didn't know that. Though the chemistry is complicated and much disputed, artificial light in the evenings may also keep brain serotonin levels elevated. And I did just recently see a study about how reading messages at night, like, let's say you wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning, and you check your cell phone, that artificial light from the cell phone actually disrupts your circadian rhythms, and it produces serotonin that makes your body go, oh, it's daytime, and now you've just screwed up your sleep cycle. Artificial light in the evenings may also disrupt brain serotonin levels and prevent the conversion of serotonin to exactly melatonin. And melatonin is what helps regulate our circadian rhythms, without which we don't feel sleepy. So it's not directly serotonin. It's the byproduct of serotonin, which is melatonin. All right, but this is where it gets more interesting. Dopamine resistance is also well documented. Now, this is what we've been looking at the last few days, the brain production of dopamine through reward systems, one of which being video games, being your, you know, every time you get an email on your smartphone and you go check it, it's that Pavlovian response. Dopamine resistance is also well documented. So think about this. Our levels, so they're saying what we've been saying, our levels of what we can handle. So like the first time there was a beheading, let's say, you know, one of the jihadis, quote unquote jihadis, had a quote unquote beheading. Everyone, oh my goodness, it was just atrocious. And now there have been so many quote unquote beheadings. Everyone goes, no, another beheading. And that's how they've been faking us all this time. You know, they come up with something and it's this movie script type thing, or, you know, they'll put a precog type thing into a movie. You know, we've talked about that many times, and we know now that lots of Hollywood and lots of the scripts and things that go through all get checked over to make sure that they're in check with what the official story is. Well, of course it is. So like right before we started having these quote unquote pandemics, didn't we start having, what was that one movie I watched? Outbreak. It was like right before that, 2011 maybe. Maybe it was mid to end 2011. I remember I watched that movie. I might have even have seen it like first run. And I was like, holy shit, that's what's happening now. Because, yeah, that's exactly how they do it. Because once the dumbass masses, and remember, media, the television was all in the movies, they were always a propaganda machine. So they can put things out there. You know how like Aunt Bessie won't believe you unless she saw it on CNN. So, you know, it's become this perfect tool for feeding info. So when I kind of lost my point, we're talking about dopamine resistance. Oh, so when they put the stuff out in movies, let's say in the future, people have already become used to the idea, and it was in the pretend world and this whole bleeding of reality versus fantasy. That happened even more once we hit the 3D first-person shooter games. You know, you started seeing it more and more, and then you had all the flight sims and then the war games, and then it became okay. You know, the, like I said yesterday, Grand Theft Auto. And we have all these children playing these games, but then we're saying, tisk, tisk, kids, you're not allowed to bite your Pop-Tart into the shape of a gun because you'll be suspended. It just, there's, you know, a reality television with, what's her name, New Jersey Shore people, you know, that people got so involved in, her Survivor, ooh, like that was even real. But people were just so involved in that stuff, like the real people and real circumstances, and more important than what's going on in the scary outside world, became like the fantasy comfort blanket. And I had mentioned the other day as well that I had read a study where they looked at people's brain scans when they were watching things such as reruns. I don't know if you remember me speaking about that, but they had found that when you watch reruns of your favorite show, the same areas of the brain lit up as did when you were spending time with your best friend or someone you really cared about. Like, how messed up is that? So they get you to create an association with these characters, I'd call them, including even like news people, the characters. You start to relate to these people and feel like you know them. And then they use them, and that relationship you form with them, that trust that you feel with them, to then manipulate your emotions. So anyway, now we're looking at the chemicals involved in manipulating your emotions. So let's dig a little bit deeper. Dopamine resistance is also well documented. Stimuli that trigger our reward centers will release dopamine, which is related to feelings of excitement and anticipation. Think of Charlie Sheen, cocaine and hookers, and you've got a recipe for dopamine resistance. Oh, that was awesome. I like Charlie. I hate to say it. It's a personality. The crazy, not the crazy people, but the ones who like to push it to the nth degree. The same brain chemistry can be achieved to a lesser extent via dedicated use, here we go, of video games, political news, porn, gambling, or any of the myriad of things that we can become addicted to. See, it's the addictive center. Reduced sensitivity levels to various hormones and neurotransmitters have a variety of effects, but none of them are as good. Fat, depressed, bored, numb, anxious, irritable, the list goes on. So, how do we increase our sensitivity to our own chemical control system? In some cases, less stimulation works. With less sugar and starch, our circulating insulin quickly drops, and our cells become more sensitive to the effects of insulin. Anyone who knows, who's taken any type of substance, that you build up a, what's it called? When you start building up a resistance to it, knows that if you back off for a little bit, then you get back. I mean, even alcohol is the same way. You know, you could drink one beer and it wipes you out. But if you drink one beer every night of the week, well, by Friday, you're probably going to need two beers, right? All right, so let's get back to the story. In the case of dopamine, exercise can increase both dopamine production and receptor sites. And I'll tell you, when I was really on my super duper health kick back about a year and a half ago, where I exercised every day, I did those crazy core exercises in a regimen. I just cannot even tell you how much better I felt 100% all the way around, mentally and physically. And so I would 100% agree with their conclusion here. If we're experiencing problems with motivation and excitement about life, then exercise may provide a fix. So there you go. And I can tell you too, it definitely helps with depression. In the cases of serotonin and melatonin, I experienced profound results from going a month without electric light. That's neat. As inconvenient as it was, the experiment had a shocking effect on my psychological state. My takeaway was to keep the lights lower in the evening, turn them off sooner, and use the, and I don't know what efflux, what's an efflux on my computer? Oh, it turns the color of your screen like a darker mood. So it's like sort of, instead of being bright, harsh white, it's kind of a darker, muted tone. That's kind of cool. All right, so let's continue now. We are going to look at addiction and brain modeling. One essay I keep coming back to is Paul Graham's The Acceleration of Addictiveness. Graham is onto something here, a really big idea. We discover and create substances and entertainment media that super stimulate our evolutionary reward centers via our sensory inputs and/or our chemical triggers. Sorry. Refined sugar, alcohol, cigarettes, porn, video games, gambling, alcohol, cocaine, they all trigger chemical cascades that make us feel good in the moment but have costs later on. And this cycle of addictive thing creation is speeding up, but, and remember, we've also talked about consumerism. That became an addiction as well. That was the instant gratification. This is where this whole modeling now of this new generation of little Napoleon narcissists that we've created with no sense of empathy, that are all number one with a sense of entitlement and instant gratification. The cycle of addictive thing creation is speeding up, but we're not coming up with ways to inoculate ourselves against addiction any faster. So how do we get addicted to stuff? And I'll tell you what. Yes, addicted to stuff. That was probably one of my biggest, like, come to Jesus moments. And that was really stepping out of the corporate world that did that, was me taking a look at my preoccupation with stuff. Lots of stuff, all kinds of stuff. But you know what? In the end, none of that stuff is important. And you can't take any of that stuff with you. And should your stuff be more important than all the things that we're losing that we're not paying attention to? That's the big distraction. And it's not just your stuff, though. It's all these other things. Drugs, alcohol, television, movies, video games, our electronic devices, the internet, news. It's all, like we've said, distractions. Those are the dangling carrots. They get us to chase the dangling carrots and lots of dangling carrots, but all those dangling carrots are poison and we're being manipulated by them. We need to say we don't like carrots anymore. All right. Where did I end up? Okay, so how do we get addicted to stuff? The general pattern is that stimulus triggers over-secretion and or overproduction of a neurotransmitter or hormone. To maintain homeostasis, the nervous system and or endocrine system reduces the number, or in some cases sensitivity, to receptor sites. Whatever the hormone or neurotransmitter is supposed to do, it does less of it, and we become tolerant of the substance or behavior in question. We need more of the same stimulus to get the same feeling or psychological effect. Right. So we keep increasing the need for our dosages of our electronic devices, of gambling, internet, porn, smoking, alcohol, as we expose ourselves. And the sad fact of the matter is, once we start looking at this transhumanist bullshit, you see that that's how it's forced us to the point now where everybody is ready to, not everybody, but a vast majority of the people who are being manipulated and controlled are ready to step right up, give their DNA swab, get into the database, and take the chip. This is that whole seven deadly sins. I mean, I hate to say it, guys. I really hate to say it because I've never been any type of religious crazy. But I'll tell you what, if there ever was, we were looking for a sign about, you know, the take the chip, don't take the chip. This embracing of the entire paradigm shift that's coming, this disruptive technology, this integration of electronics with biology, this synthetic takeover of our biological ecosystems from a cellular level is the taking of the chip. This is the usurpation of life on planet Earth. How much more evil can that be? That is a bunch of lunatic psychopaths deeming themselves gods and covertly usurping Mother Nature, overthrowing the natural order of things. Isn't that? I mean, if you took any of the historic texts and kind of twisted them 2 degrees to the right, backed the truck up and took a look at it from a higher perspective, isn't that kind of the picture that it was painting, regardless of the characters? Because I think so. I think this is it, man. This is this whole thing that's happening right now. And I mean, it's got so many facets. We have so many different people on this network that talk about all the different facets of the usurpation, but it's all part of the same whole. It's a complete and utter takeover. But as we've discovered, digging into the nano bits and bytes, it's gone to the insanity of an atomic, not even cellular, an atomic level. They've hijacked us. All right, read a little bit more of this. Cocaine and meth are both stimulants, but they also affect the dopamine system in different ways. Cocaine prevents the reuptake of dopamine, while amphetamines cause more dopamine to be excreted. The end result is similar: too much dopamine and neurotransmitter byproducts of the dopamine bouncing around in the brain. Now, we read a story yesterday that had done quite an extensive study showing that the excessive need for dopamine is what they have pinpointed as the cause or one of the many causes of psychopaths. So what all these, what we're understanding here is we are creating in this 1.0 generation of humans that they're looking to usurp and replace and augment and integrate and assimilate to steal all the ideas that Mother Nature used for their own nefarious means, copy and reproduce and then patent and then infiltrate. They are turning what is left, these last few purely biological organisms, if they are still even that. I mean, don't think the vaccines haven't been working on things. Remember Kurzweil, back in an interview we heard at, it's Thursday, so maybe it's the beginning of this week, end of last week, part of last week, Kurzweil had said this is already well underway. They are turning, I think actually we're at generation 1.5. I really think my generation, Generation X, was probably the last generation that was 1.0, and they started experimenting on our food at that time. You know, nanotechnology started, we found out from Drexler at MIT in 1978. And I can pinpoint my beginnings of my health issues, which I know was all tied to the stuff. I've documented it all for 20 plus years. My health issues started in the early 90s with the chronic fatigue syndrome, right around the time that all started happening with the veterans as well, when they got the anthrax vaccine. You know, that was also when I got that one and only flu shot I ever had, and they were giving it away free at the college. So who knows what was in there? Anyway, let's not get too far off the topic. I just want to kind of stitch all these, every single point we've been talking about. And I mean, we literally are on 9 or 10 weeks now of this lecture that's just gone unending for days. I just want to stitch all these pieces together because they're not separate in any way, shape, or form, and they're not crazy. This is all biology, technology, biotechnology, you know, even genetic engineering. You know, wait until you hear now, after we looked at precision medicine and stuff, wait till you hear about this story I heard this morning about the mobile genetics lab now that can travel around. All right, anyway, so cocaine and methamphetamine react differently in the brain, but the end result is the same. An overly large amount of dopamine. And of course, like I said, we found out yesterday that they've discovered now in studies that that causes psychopathy. This leads, this overabundance of dopamine leads to excitement and feelings of anticipation in the short term, but severely dips in energy and motivation later on. The brain becomes less sensitive to dopamine as a way to protect itself and restore balance. But when the chemical stimulus is removed, the brain is still desensitized to dopamine and needs more to feel normal. Behavior can desensitize even a drug-free brain. Risky behaviors, pastimes, and careers such as extreme sports, high-stakes finance, and professional gambling can model the brain in powerful ways. So can intense, life-changing experiences like people who like to jump out of airplanes or defuse bombs. A brain that has been to war, here we go, is not the same as a brain that has not been to war. And they've said that many times. You become desensitized. Some people are attracted to the novelty and excitement because of genetic factors that the brain structure of the brain structure and the neurophysiology. But behavior models our brain above and beyond the effects of genetics. So this person starts talking about their own issues. I don't know if I really want to talk about this guy's own issues because we have a bunch of other stuff. The paleo fix. Oh, and he talks about morality. You know what? We talked about that as well. And that fine line. And even if you have a psychopathic brain, if you have that line of morals or ethics that you won't cross, it actually gives you laser vision into that other frame of mind that you don't allow yourself to interact with, let's say. All right, the paleo fix, pragmatism over morality. Biological evolution works slowly. Some of us carry mutations that allow us to better digest dairy products, grains, and other Neolithic foods, but most humans are still best adapted for a hunter-gatherer lifestyle featuring intermittent fasting, a diet of highly nutritious animal and plants, daily exercise, no electric lights, no computers, plenty of leisure time and rest, a clearly defined social role, or loose or non-existent power hierarchies. If we become resistant to insulin, leptin, serotonin, dopamine, and/or cortisol, we can resensitize our brains and bodies with a more paleolithic lifestyle. Maybe that's why living simply feels so good. Less food, fewer carbohydrates, intermittent fasting, less artificial light, less screen time, less alcohol and caffeine. Oh, God. Though I'll tell you, when I quit coffee for a couple years, and that took a lot for me. I only do 2 cups now a day, but I used to do like a pot a day and then decided I had to stop doing some caffeine for a while. And I felt so much better. That instantaneous get out of bed, like without much prompting or hitting the snooze ever, was quite amazing. With less alcohol, caffeine, fewer drugs, more exercise, more play, more rest, more sleep, more human contact, more personal freedom, including freedom from tyranny and strict control structures, and work that makes us feel useful and appreciated will generally resensitize receptors and/or effectively regulate production of the neurotransmitters and hormones that we need to feel happy, energetic, motivated, connected, relaxed, and fully alive. God, that was a mouthful, but he is speaking the truth more than any truth that I have heard here in probably the last 4 years. That's exactly it. That is the cure. And all those things that they are doing to us, all the restrictiveness, all the fear, all the hate, all the making you feel like you're not getting anywhere, like we're being defeated, fighting amongst ourselves, all that stuff works against us and makes us unmotivated, unenergetic, unhappy, unrelaxed, and unalive. That's what they're hoping for. It makes you vulnerable. Okay. It says, but the point is not to become the most sensitized human being. If you deprive yourself of flavorful food and food in general, then even the bland gruel will make your brain explode with delight. But so what? Does that matter? You mean that you're better than everyone else? It just means that you've been depriving yourself. And that's true. You know, I had a boss for many years, and he was a very, very, very wise man. He had multiple black belts, and he had spent his entire adult life mastering, I believe his skill was jujitsu, and it was Mandarin. He was one of the Mandarin arts, but he was a double black belt and an instructor. He wanted to open his own dojo. And he was an executive vice president and had been for many years. And he mentored me. He was great. He was probably my favorite boss out of every boss I ever had. And one of the things that he taught me was that despite all the crazy, we worked for a company that was just completely insane. And it was like lunatics running the fucking asylum half the time, if not three quarters of the time. But he used to tell me, Jewel, you know, it's all in moderation. It doesn't matter what it is, it's always moderation. As long as you stay the course, and sometimes you let it go, and sometimes you pick your battles, you always come out on top. And the same thing with food, the same thing with activity. You could do a little bit of anything and everything. Check it out, try it out for the level of experience, but don't go overboard. And you know what? I've actually used that in my life a lot over the last couple of years. And when I start feeling myself get pressed or off the getting ready to like look off an edge, I tell myself that and I back up the truck, Chuck. All right, it says, nor is there any moral high ground in taking the natural route to health, especially mental health. While I believe there is, in most cases, a more paleolithic lifestyle, that's a faster cure for mild depression and anxiety. It is not necessarily the easiest starting point for someone with serious depression, bipolar disorder, OCD, schizoaffective disorder, or other neurological conditions that destroy the quality of life. Intelligently administered psychiatric drugs. I don't know if I would say it was a reasonable choice necessarily before they looked at natural roots, but whatever. The point is not to become an aesthetic or hunter-gatherer because those are superior, more pure lifestyles. The point is to understand what's happening in your own brain and body and to take effective measures when you get out of whack. And you will get out of whack at times because you live in modernized civilization. Modern civilization is awesome. He lists off increased lifespan, widespread literacy, coffee, 3D movies, and Minecraft, but it can strain our still mostly paleolithic psyche and psychology, physiology to an extreme degree. He had a lot of good points, so I'm going to give him that. Now, if Skype is going to let me connect here, there was a story that came out yesterday using, again, I think they were using one of those ECG helmets on some test subjects. And they discovered that just texting has caused a different type of interaction when they're looking at our brain scans between our thumbs and our brains than when we're not texting. And that's a scary thought. I mean, it literally is changing the way our limbs are interacting with our sensory cortex. So hold on one second.
Constant smartphone typing has become part of our daily lives. It's changing our brains, say European researchers. Dr. Arko Ghosh of ETH Zurich at the University of Zurich hooked up right-handed volunteers to EEG brainwave caps. Ghosh examined how subjects' brains process touch from their thumb, forefinger and middle finger, alongside the history of the smartphone interactions recorded by their phone logs. University of Fribourg student Magalai Shitaris helped study the findings.
So we used the logs from the battery logs from the phones, and we found that if the EEG recording was just after a peak of high intense of use, then the brain activity was higher.
Activity in the brain's cortex associated with the thumb and index fingertips was directly proportional to the intensity of phone use.
These red spots here indicate that when you measure the signals from these electrodes, a lot of the differences between one person and the next can be explained simply by how much phone they were using in the previous 10 days.
The results, published in Current Biology, suggests repetitive touchscreen movements reshape cortical sensory processing. Ghosh says smartphone is an ideal way for brain plasticity and plans to conduct further tests.
It gives us a very good excuse to go back and look into some greater detail to understand how our digital histories could be used to understand brain function and develop real-world solutions by studying a real-world example of brain.
I had to disconnect. One thing I find really disturbing about what he was talking about, I don't know if you heard that, but he was saying that by studying phone logs closely, they were studying like battery power usage, which corresponds to when the phone was in use and they were texting or doing whatever they were doing. And he was saying that by studying phone logs closely, it'll give them this whole library of research for them to do more research on brains and how they interact with these things. And I mean, we should all be worried that just using the small device that they've now gotten us all addicted to, and I think we've established that with our dopamine production and how it interacts with our brain. I mean, this is physically changing the way our brains function. So what else are we doing, or what else are they presenting us or providing us with that starts to change the way our brains function? And could this then become evolutionary? So in the future, you know, maybe a child that is born to a mother that has never known any different, like this generation that's coming through now that's always had smart devices, let's say, are they going to pass? We've looked at some of the epigenome. are they going to pass some of those traits, even though they may not be genetic traits, they've changed the way their physical body is interacting. Is that trait going to be passed on to future children? And so, you know, like a prime example, I saw this story, I think this might have been early hours of this morning. Ford's new car will force you to obey the speed limit. Now, anyone who's been listening to this show for a while knows that one of my last bastions of freedom is to get into my car, open the windows, the sunroof, and turn the music up high and hit the road. And, you know, self-driving cars kind of gave me chills because that's all I was thinking is one of these days they're going to tell us we can't drive. But how about is the stepping stone to that? We have some intelligence in a car that can actually scan to see what the speed limit is and then throttle back your gasoline that's being allowed to the engine to stop you from going any faster. And we're going to read the story. And what's that going to do to us in the future? Like, as things start to get taken over, like, anyone ever see the movie WALL-E, Disney? Right? They didn't have to think anymore. They didn't have to do anything anymore. They didn't even have to walk anymore. And these people were shown as like these big blobby creatures that just had no definition, that sat in these little chairs that putted around with screens embedded to them. And they never even really realized that they were flying through outer space because they interacted through the screen. And I mean, the Matrix, so you plug in, right? The whole world was just destroyed, but there was this whole other world that was like it used to be once you plugged into the Matrix. So anyway, all right, let's read this. Ford's new car will force you to obey the speed limit. This is out of Engadget. Much as we like to emulate our NASCAR heroes, breaking the speed limit often comes at a price. Ford is hoping to prevent accidents and speeding tickets by introducing cars that can see what the speed limit is and preventing heavy-footed motorists from driving any faster. Ford's intelligent speed limiter technology will first appear on its new Ford S-Max that's launching in Europe that could just change the way that we drive. A camera mounted on the windshield scans the road signs on the sides of the highway, and when the vehicle enters the 20-mile-an-hour zone, the system reduces the top-notch speed to match. Rather than controlling the speed with automatic braking, the car limits its own velocity by adjusting the amount of fuel that is being pushed to the engine. If a burst of speed is required, however, users can either deactivate the system by pressing the button on the console or temporarily get past it with a hard press on the gas pedal. Yes, I'm sure a lot of people will be doing that. Stop, stop, stop. If the vehicle is coasting downhill and starts to build up speed, the car will sense its motion and sound an alarm to get you to brake. It's not the only bit of new safety tech available on the new whip either, since deep-pocketed motorists can also get pedestrian detection and collision warnings. This frees up drivers to wonder why any car firm would call a car Smax, S-Max, and think we wouldn't notice. Ha, ha, ha. And there is a clip with this one as well, so might as well check it out. Here we go.
Across Europe, there are 35,000 safety cameras and counting. In some countries, speed limits are getting lower and the fines are getting bigger and bigger. Drivers have never needed to be more attentive to avoid speeding. So, beginning with the all-new Ford S-Max, Ford has introduced Intelligent Speed Limiter. Drivers can choose to activate Intelligent Speed Limiter using the steering wheel controls. Intelligent Speed Limiter enables drivers to manually set a maximum vehicle speed. The maximum speed is then automatically adjusted according to information from the traffic sign recognition system that reads road signs and overtaking restrictions and displays them in the instrument cluster. Cars with onboard navigation can also use map data to support the system on long country roads where there may be fewer traffic signs. The system smoothly controls speed using engine torque by electronically adjusting the amount of fuel delivered, rather than applying the brakes. If the vehicle overruns the set speed limit because of a downhill gradient,
an acoustic warning is triggered. As with all Ford speed limiting technology, drivers can temporarily override the system by pressing firmly on the accelerator.
Yes, that was a Ford video. Ford, go further. You know, don't think they're going to be the only ones. Everybody is also getting into the self-driving car technology. I saw Mercedes, I believe, just introduced a new car as well. Google, of course, has theirs. I'm sure General Motors is working on one. You know, there's all kinds of crazy stuff. Speaking of General Motors, I want to bring up a story, too, that I saw SLC Mike drop yesterday into chat, and that is in regards to this corporation called HRL Laboratories. They formed an LLC a while ago, and they do research in partnerships with these LLC companies. Two of the companies that are LLC partners that work together with this HRL Laboratories happen to be Boeing and General Motors in a sort of like a partnership. Yeah, they're LLC members. So this company's doing R&D for the Boeing company and General Motors. So I don't know if they're working together. But check this out. This is what their mission statement is. Our research collaborations with our LLC member companies, governments, commercial, and academic institutions are realizing groundbreaking advances in ultra-performance circuitry, robust computing, communications, automated data extraction, and innovative architected materials. Our technologies operate in space and aircraft, in automobiles, and in a variety of consumer products. And these technologies, of course, make us safer, support our national security, and improve our quality of life. Oh, let's be happy. Let them take over with technology. One other thing I wanted to mention in regards to cars that caught my attention a few days back is that Pigmine posted a video about them now. You know, everything is about global warming. And, of course, with global warming comes carbon. And with carbon comes pollution. And with pollution, you're not going to be able to burn fires anymore because the EPA says no. And they're going to go after cars. And I really think that this is how they're going to push the self-driving technology, is that you don't need to own a car anymore. We'll just have a fleet of self-driving cars like taxis. And then you can, you know, order one on your smartphone that shows up. And we'll take 12 qubits from your cashless society bank account to pay for it when you had to go to the store. But here in Paris, all of a sudden, I thought I saw 50% of vehicles might have to come off the roads. Was it that much here? Let's just play this for a second. Because just like China, I guess Paris is now choked with smog. Is there no narration in this? I guess not, so I'll have to narrate. Cars with only odd number plates will be allowed to drive. Restrictions are aimed at pollution in the city. That was pretty useless. I mean, for watching it is, but not for air. Says French authorities on Monday put in place emergency traffic limiting measures in Paris as the city of light and much of northern France suffers from a choking smog. I mean, this type of thing, as we're talking about desensitization, and we see these little things that are, you know, very New World orderly things that happen here. They happen in Germany. They happen in Australia. They happen in the UK. You know, and of course they make news, but what they do is they quietly usher in us getting used to these ideas. So then when they decide that they're going to pull the trigger on the rest of the world, we'll all say, yeah, well, they did that in France. Yeah, well, they were doing that in China. So it ends up being okay. And I'm not saying that smog is a good thing, but on the other hand, pay attention to how we're being manipulated. That manipulation is how we are losing everything. All right. And talking about losing everything, losing our ability to control our own bodies is something we spent a lot of time on, talking about nanotech, talking about vaccines, talking about mandatory vaccines and some of the synthetic biology that is being integrated into our environment, into our food, into our air, into our water, into our pharmaceuticals, our vitamins, that are all ending up in our bodies. And we are the guinea pigs. The bees are definitely canaries in the coal mine. You know, when we see and listen to see what's happening, but listen to Dr. Huber in regards to yesterday, this whole manganese and dopamine connection, that I really need to start pulling that sweater thread to understand a little bit more. But the glyphosate causing the body not to absorb proper nutrients, the plants, the animals, the glyphosate damaging the beneficial bacteria in these organisms, which then causes not to be able to properly process food and nutrients, the intake. The bees were starving, remember, even though there was plenty of bee bread and food. Well, as they begin to understand science more and more of how these biological systems work, don't think that the mad scientists gone mad aren't going to start sprinkling some of their inventions out into that real-time petri dish that allows them to take, remember, their R&D budget, which used to be a line item, and investors didn't like them spending all those trillions of dollars on research. Now, you don't have to have a huge lab with petri dishes. Now you just have a little lab with a bunch of scientists that, whoop, accidentally let her escape into the environment. We just saw that again in Louisiana, didn't we? That didn't make a lot of fanfare, but some virulent material escaped. It was from monkeys, but somebody, one of the researchers or a contractor, I believe, had shown in their blood serum that they'd been exposed to it, even though they didn't show any symptoms. Ebola again, Ebola round two. We got Sierra. I think it was Sierra Leone is now under lockdown with what do they call it when they don't let you go out? I don't know. I guess it is a quarantine, but they have the curfews. You can't leave your house. They also have it in, there was Sierra Leone, Guinea. Again, there's another resurgence. They're doing vaccinations. They just finished it in Guinea. And now I saw as well, hold the phone 1 second. I don't know if I put that one on this page. Hold on. If not, I know where it is. China. When did we hear? I didn't, so I have to go to the other page. When did we hear that China had also been working on their own Ebola vaccine? Because I know I hadn't. There were like six other projects, but I had not heard about China here. And this article was titled very innocuously, New Ebola Vaccine Provokes Immune Response in Human Clinical Trials. Because we know, of course, they had already started clinical trials. The one that they declared a success was the one in Guinea. And now they're having a slight outbreak again, right? We said, how damn convenient is that? Because they didn't get the stock money, these vac companies, the first round, because it all died out. So now there's a second resurgence. I had seen last week that they had brought a bunch of aid workers to the U.S. We read that story. There was only one story I managed to see on that. They were taking them to one of like five or six different institutions around the United States, but they were putting them in hotels. They're putting them on their own terms, quarantine, and some of them weren't going to self-quarantine at all. They were suspected, people that had had contact with a confirmed case. Anyway, let's read this Ebola story that sounds innocuous. It says scientists have published the results of a phase one human trial on a new Ebola vaccine based on the 2014 strain. So this was the one that was traveling around Africa, and suggest that this is not only safe to use, but it does what a good vaccine is supposed to do. It provokes an immune response. There are several different Ebola vaccines now in development by research institutions all over the world, but this one is the first one to directly address the current strain of the virus. So this to me is almost sounding like this is an old school type vaccine, like we used to have polio where they would put first the live and then people got it and then the killed polio in to get your body to have an official immune response to the real pathogen. It says the team led by Fenke Zhu from the Jiangsu Provincial Center for Disease Prevention and Control in China tested the vaccine in a trial involving 120 healthy Chinese adult volunteers. I don't know how many of those do you want to bet were volunteer. I think they were probably instructed that their number was up. You can either go to jail or you could test my vaccine. The volunteers were split into three groups and assigned either a placebo, a low dose of vaccine called the recombinant andiovirus type 5 vaccine, or a high dose. After 28 days, the team reports in The Lancet that 38 of the 40 patients who received the low dose of the vaccine and all of the 40 of those who received the high dose of the vaccine showed a positive immune response to the vaccine. The volunteers who received a high dose also ended up producing more antibodies in response to than those in the low-dose volunteer group, which we would absolutely expect, understanding the way that traditional vaccinations worked. A major limitation of the study is that researchers were not able to test if the immune response provoked by the vaccine would be enough to actually fight the evil virus and protect a person from contracting the disease. The team now plans to test in Africa and aims to test the immune response for longer than 28 days of the study, but they have a rough road ahead. While no adverse side effects were found in the participants of the trial, previous research with the vaccine has shown that immunity to the virus vector used to deliver the drug could hinder its effectiveness, which is something the team will have to figure out. But they say that the fact that 100% of the volunteers who received the high dose responded positively means that partly they are at least being circumvented by an increased dosage. So I don't know how interesting is that, that there's a Chinese study when they were talking about all the different studies when, you know, we had this quote unquote outbreak. I had not heard of the Chinese one, and the Chinese from the way this sounds, and I did not actually see any major details, but it almost using a recombinant, that's the way they did kind of old school vaccinating as opposed to all of this genetically modified RNAi, genetically modified tobacco crap that they were doing involved. All right, so as we get to the end of the show, I guess here we're going to look at this last piece. Mobile DNA sequencer shows potential for disease surveillance. Now, as we've been talking about Obamacare and precision healthcare and the genome and getting your DNA into a database as part of this healthcare program and the electronic medical health records, oh, how wonderful a mobile DNA sequencer would be now, wouldn't it? It says a pocket-sized device that can rapidly determine the sequence of an organism's DNA has shown its potential in disease detection, according to a study published in the open access, open data journal GigaScience. In the first analysis of its kind, researchers were able to use the device to accurately identify a range of closely related bacteria and viruses within 6 hours, demonstrating the potential for this technology to be used as a mobile diagnostic clinic during outbreaks. Yeah. And then at some point, it's going to be freaking FEMA camp as you line up. They're going to put you right in that genetic database to determine who is the type of genes we need to test on tomorrow. Shit like this, to me, is not good at all. The Minion, M-I-N, and then capital I-O-N, so it's like Min-Ion, but it's Minion Nanopore Sequencer, is a low-cost, palm-sized sequencing device from Oxford Nanopore Technologies that has been made available to some research groups for testing. It is powered and operated via USB connected to a plugged-in laptop, which means that it could potentially be used for on-site chemical analyses in remote locations, negating the need for samples to be sent off to laboratories. Lead author Andrew Kilikansky from Edgewood Chemical Biological Center, USA, wonder if that's in Colorado, whose team tested the device in a joint collaboration with Signature Science LLC, said, quote, our findings are important because we have for the first time communicated to the community that this technology can be extremely useful in its current state. Being able to accurately identify and characterize strains of virus and bacteria using a mobile platform is attractive to anyone collecting biological samples in the field. And we expect that as technology improves, the sequencing will generally become cheaper, faster, more accurate, and could have further clinical applications. Ding, 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 ding. The researchers were able to use the mini-ion to accurately identify and differentiate viral and bacterial species from samples, and within 6 hours, the device generated sufficient data to identify an E. coli sample down to its species level. Three pox viruses, cowpox, Vaccinia MVA, and Vaccinia Lister, down to a strain level. The device was also able to distinguish between two Vaccinia strains, despite them being closely related and over 98% similar to each other. The technology relies on protein nanopores to determine the sequence of a strand of DNA. So there you go. They're handheld DNA sequencers, people. And at the core of the protein is a hollow tube, only a few nanometers in diameter, through which a single DNA strand can pass. And as the DNA strand passes through the nanopore, it causes characteristic electrical signatures from which bases can be identified and the sequence of the strand determined. The authors said it would be difficult to accurately characterize pathogens within a complex sample in 6 hours without applying the amplicon methodology. So there you go. DNA sequencers in a mobile unit, and we are at the end of the last 15 seconds of the show. Holy crap, how fast that comes. Make sure you stick around. Mr. Chuck Ocelli is on tonight. Actually, Ken Blanche is up next. Chuck Ocelli at 6 p.m. Eastern, Behind the Woodshed this week with Hal at 8. Double Cross with Drew and Chuck at 10. And Anti-Media Radio with S.M. Gibson. At 11 p.m. All right, guys, everyone have an awesome Thursday, and I will catch up with you tomorrow.